From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan overcomes a rough shooting game to bring home the NCAA men's national title.
This was a dogfight from the start, and you could tell, I felt, in the first half, this game was going to come down to the wire.
Then Kalamazoo novelist Maria Dong weaves an alt-horror story about two sisters who grew up stateless playing a dangerous game for their future.
Where they think that if they can fall in love with the right person, and it's kind of like the idea of a person, because it's usually a person they haven't really been with very long or in person very much, it can save them and it can fix everything.
And we speak with some farmers who took advantage of a program matching aging landowners with the next generation.
It was all made possible because of that connection of somebody 35 minutes away that without the website, we probably never would have met them.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to look into the pressure on farmers who would like to retire without losing their land to non-farm uses.
So you can see kind of that pressure on farmers to either sell their land and or sell it to a developer or a solar farm or anything else other than kind of keeping it in farming and agriculture.
There's a new service matching them up with younger Michigan farmers keeping the land for ag business. We'll share their stories in just a bit. But first, it's hard to overstate how fired up Ann Arbor is today after the Michigan Wolverines 69-63 win over UConn for the NCAA Men's College Championship. This is only Michigan's second men's basketball title ever. Around town, you could see students and other fans lining up, camping out for spots at their favorite sports bars as early as Sunday night. This is Michigan student Anya Prasad, who staked her claim at Good Time Charlie's.
My wonderful roommates got here at around 10:30 last night, and we've been doing shifts. My friend and I here, Izzy, we got here at 4:30 a.m., and we're really excited. We've had a great time in line. The spirits have been high.
When game time arrived, these fans were not disappointed.
And it's over! Hail to the champions! Hail to Michigan!
Sports commentator John Hugh Bacon spoke with Michigan Public's Morning Edition host Doug Tribou about the final. Let's take a listen.
John, Michigan had set a record by scoring 90 or more points in five consecutive games in one NCAA tournament. Then in the final against UConn, they scored just 69, but still found a way to win. What will you remember about this game?
Well, you got that one right. The first five games were basically blowouts. This was a dogfight from the start. And you could tell, Doug, I felt in the first half, this game was going to come down to the wire. And it did. Mm-hmm. And that's not too surprising going against a great UConn team in the finals. But just like you said, Michigan found a way to win. Their three-point shooting was abysmal. Doug, they had 2 3-point shots. Doug, I might have gotten 2.
That's right. And that's a wild statistic. Michigan won and only made those 2 3-pointers in the entire game. Connecticut had 9.
Yes, which is much more, by the way. So that's a 21-point difference right there. But Michigan made almost 90% of their free throws, and they played great team defense. That is not flashy or fancy basketball, but it is fundamentally great basketball. And like you said, they always find a way to win one day, one way, the next day.
Yaxel Lindeborg, the Big Ten Player of the Year and a key factor for Michigan all season, was in the game despite a sprained knee and ankle. He had those injuries in the previous game on Saturday. Even with his mobility somewhat limited, he was the team's second leading scorer, had 13 points, and he gave them a key burst in a short stretch in the second half. How important has he been for the Wolverines in the tournament and throughout the season?
Well, look, let's be clear. He's their best player, and it's not all that close. Even at 80%, Yaxel was clearly better than his sub. That's why he's in the game. If he's out point blank, Michigan loses. It's not just the points. It's his presence down low. It's his ability to draw UConn defenders. So that was a gutsy, gutsy, and vital performance.
Well, let's talk some more about point guard Elliot Cadeau. He had a great game, 19 points, just 2 assists, but also had 2 steals and so much leadership on the floor, just a sense of control when he's handling the basketball and taking it to the hoop. What did you see in his performance?
If the team scores 69 and one guy's got 19, yeah, that's important.
That's right.
But look, it's more important this game because with Yaxel unable to carry the team, as he often did, somebody had to pick up the slack, and it was Cadeau. And he played with all the confidence that he lacked last year playing for UNC, North Carolina. So don't give up, kids. You never know.
A lot has been made about the way head coach Dusty May and his staff constructed their roster. Some of the team's biggest stars this season are transfers, Elliot Cadeau, Yaxel Lendenborg, Merez Johnson, and the big man, 7'3", Adai Mara, all came to Michigan through the transfer portal. Of course, there's also name, image, and likeness money that's now involved across college sports to attract players to universities. John, there are fans who love this, many U of M fans this morning, very happy about it. And there are fans who can't stand it. Your thoughts on a title built in part on transfers?
Well, as you said, some hate it, some like it, including, I think, a lot of very recent Michigan converts to that theory. But it's here to stay. It must be said, though, that only Yaxel Lendeborg was expected to have a big year for Michigan. The coach at UCLA had given up on Adai Mara. He was riding the bench there. The coach at North Carolina had given up on Elliot Cadeau. So you have to give Dusty May some credit here. Those guys are looking pretty good now, so it worked.
UConn won the national championship in 2023 and again in 2024. They were trying for their third title under coach Dan Hurley. The Wolverines coach Dusty May is in his second year at Michigan. He came in to replace former Michigan star player Juwan Howard, who had some ups and some downs during his 5 years as head coach. What have you noticed about May's leadership and coaching in his short time here in Ann Arbor?
Steady Eddie, mature beyond his years. He seems to know what to do in just about every situation, on and off the court. And I'm still waiting for his first mistake. But a bigger point, by the way, the celebration you played earlier, I was part of the last one, Doug. It was 37 years ago, and apparently I was younger then. The same weekend, the Grateful Dead, Hash Bash, and the national title all at once. That was true insanity. So I hope Michigan fans appreciate this.
Student turned commentator John Ubakin, thank you very much.
Didn't see that coming 37 years ago.
John Ubakin is the author of 14 books. His latest is his 8th national bestseller, The Gales of November, The Untold Story of the Edmund Fitzgerald, is out now. And a note, the University of Michigan holds Michigan Public's broadcast license.
In other stories we're following, Michigan's newcomers are still under a lot of pressure as federal officers have ramped up immigration enforcement. An immigrant rights advocate in Detroit has been doing all she can to support people without permanent legal status. Then her own nephew got picked up by ICE. Michigan Public's Beenish Ahmed brought us this story.
After graduating a semester early from high school in Detroit, Moore Ba was on a mission. A couple of days before Thanksgiving, he dropped by to see his aunt, Sadie Saar, to get going on his college applications.
He had brought all his paperwork and all his recommendation letters for college, and he was so happy.
But Saar was busy preparing to host Thanksgiving. She told him to come back after the holiday to work on his applications. The next morning, she started getting call after call from Ba. He can be pretty persistent. Saar feels responsible for Ba. He's 19 years old and came to the U.S. as an unaccompanied minor from Senegal. He doesn't have any other family here besides his aunt.
And I picked up the phone and I'm like, boy, it's only because you're graduating early that you're going to have, you wake up in the morning and calling me 25,000 times, what's up? And he said, hey, auntie, I'm here at the ICE. And I'm like, what you doing at ICE?
Ba told her immigration officers arrested him while they were looking for someone else. Ba doesn't have a criminal record and wasn't breaking any laws.
I just wake up one morning trying to go to work, and I go out of my house, and I get arrested by ICE.
Saar was shocked. Ba is an asylum seeker and was finally a few months away from his first big hearing. Saar runs an immigrant rights organization for people from Africa. Until recently, as long as asylum seekers showed up for court, did their check-ins, and didn't get in trouble with the law, they weren't targeted for enforcement.
They were told that if you file for asylum, we told them that.
file for your asylum. The asylum is supposed to protect you.
That changed after President Trump took office and began a mass deportation campaign. Now, asylum seekers like Ba are getting detained. Sar has worked on immigration issues for years, but even she didn't know how to get her nephew out of the North Lake Detention Center.
We had to pivot quickly.
She called advocates and lawyers in other states, and they told her to file a habeas petition in federal court.
I never heard of habeas being filed in immigration cases. And they were like, yeah, you have a little slither, but you can slit in here because we have been filing these habeas and getting our people out because that's the only way right now to go.
The only way to get Ba out was through federal court, forcing the government to explain why he was being detained or release him on bond. After 2 months in detention, a judge granted Ba a $10,000 bond. Since immigration cases require payment upfront in full, Sar had to hustle to raise that money. Then, in late January, she made the four-hour drive to the North Lake Detention Center.
Yes, yes, yes! We're getting you home!
Let's take a picture. Sar embraced Ba in the parking lot. Though Ba missed his chance to start college this semester, he's working again and preparing to start classes later this year. Sometimes, though, the trauma of being locked up keeps him up at night.
Sometimes he's coming in my mind and I can't sleep because, like, I see, like, a lot of friends over there. They don't do nothing and they were there for no reason.
Ba knows he's one of the lucky ones. He spent months in detention, filed a federal lawsuit, and paid a steep bond just to end up where he was before he got arrested with the exact same date for his asylum hearing.
So getting him home, the feeling, you know, it's a good feeling. I don't want people to go through what we went through to have that feeling.
For Sar, that relief was short-lived. 1 week after she picked Ba up, another young person she cares for, her cousin's son, was arrested by ICE. Sar just paid a bond to get him out of North Lake, too. Beenish Ahmed, Michigan Public News.
We're going to take a quick pause now. After that, a Kalamazoo writer talks about her new novel featuring two sisters who grew up stateless. She says that the whole concept had a pretty unusual origin.
So this book was originally inspired by an episode of 90 Day Fiancé.
We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When you start a story by Kalamazoo writer Maria Dong, you're going all the way down the rabbit hole. Her immersive thrillers can draw you into situations where characters are facing mortal danger. But honestly, it's the psychological dangers they face that'll really get under your skin. Her second book, Aviary, tells the story of two sisters who grew up stateless and on the run. A mysterious artist residency program might offer them stability and a path forward, but there's international boundary transgression, queer female bonding through art, and a crazed billionaire whose motives are almost certainly not what they seem. Maria Dong joins us now to talk about Aviary. Maria, welcome back to Stateside.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me back. I'm so excited to talk about this book.
So this story is about Hee Jin, this young woman who grew up with her sister Hee Young. They grew up really, really hard mostly in South Korea, but they have, as we'll get into, a pretty complicated family backstory. And they take this journey. Both end up taking this journey to the United States into sort of like a twisted artist colony. How did these particular settings start to occur for you?
Okay, I'm going to go on record by saying please don't immediately reject the book outright when you hear this, listeners, because it's going to sound a little unhinged, but this is how my brain operates. So this book was originally inspired by an episode of 90 Day Fiancé.
Okay, I've finished the book and I can't wait to see how you're going to thread this needle.
First of all, I think the show is like such a perfect and beautifully sad encapsulation of capitalism and how it affects people psychologically. There's so many people on that show who are in desperate financial or legal straits, and There's no, they can't see a way out, right? And then they get this idea, either, you know, they absorb it through media or it's, you know, it comes up from themselves, where they think that if they can fall in love with the right person, and it's kind of like the idea of a person, because it's usually a person they haven't really been with very long or in person very much, that it can save them and it can fix everything, right? This idea that like, oh, over in, you know, this other country, things will be better. Or when this person comes here, everything's going to be all better. And a lot of times there's a lot of lying involved where they don't tell this other person about what their life is actually like. And
shocker.
So,
shocker.
Yeah. I was watching an episode of this show where there's like these two wives. I'm going to call them old wife and new wife, not because one is older necessarily, but just like the original wife and then the 90-day fiancé wife. And the first wife, when they initially interview her, she's really nervous about what happened. She was in this long marriage. Her husband woke up one day and decided he didn't want to be married anymore. They had two almost adult children. And so they get divorced. And then he finds this other wife and he imports her, right? And she's like 18 or something. And so the first wife is just like, I'm so nervous about this. What does this mean for my children? Whatever. But then once the new wife arrives, the two women start talking to each other and realizing like, oh, we have a mutual problem in a way. We're both, you know, have been married or are married to this very immature person. And so they kind of like start teaming up and doing like household chores together and childcare together and like kind of forming this like, you know, work unit. And I was so taken by that dynamic. And so it like it kind of like put a little seed in my brain. And then everything else that I watched or saw or read for the next like 2 years kind of started like poking itself into that little seed. And so like there were all these different influences that wound up in this book. Like this is really sad, but when the Atlanta spa shootings happened, that really devastated me.
Right. For those who may not remember, this was the shooting of, I mean, I think nearly a dozen women who were working as quote unquote massage therapists, and they were all Asian American sort of in a forced labor condition.
Yeah. And one of the women has a name pattern that kind of, if you are Korean, you hear that name pattern and you just go, oh, this is a woman of like, you know, she was either born in the very early 70s, late 60s. Like it's a way that was really common at the time of naming your children. And my mom has that name pattern. And a lot of her story really was a lot like my own mom's story. And it was really hard for me at that moment to not see my mom and how easily things could have gone in a different direction. And, you know, there were a lot of conversations happening at the time about like Asian hate and Orientalism and kind of like the intersection of what patriarchy teaches people about what we should expect from Asian women. And it was just really devastating. So that kind of found its way into this book.
Going back to what you were saying about, you know, women in these labor conditions, Heejin's mom throughout the book is something of a cipher, partly because Heejin like never got the whole story of her mom's life. But I don't think it's giving away too much of the plot to say that we learn that she was essentially sold as a slave and throughout the girl's childhood. And one of the things that really drew me into the book was actually not just, okay, that fact is a plot point, but reading about and thinking through what it would mean to grow up in those conditions. Not just, you know, terribly poor, not just working poor, but literally not being able to have any agency over your life in any sense. What was it like for you to sort of walk through that, through Heejin and Heeyoung's experiences?
Obviously, I did a ton of research and I talked to quite a few people. A lot of people don't know this, but the question of statelessness and identity and statehood is very central to modern Korean culture, partially because of things that happened during Japanese occupation, where a number of Koreans were essentially trafficked to other countries and then denied citizenship in the countries they landed in and unable to go home. And so after several generations, you had people who were born in other countries like Japan, for example, that didn't have citizenship in Japan, but also didn't in Korea. But this question of like statelessness, I guess, it's a very real one. So It's something that I've thought about a lot, and I think a lot of people of Korean descent have thought about a lot. We are a very diasporic population because of the events of our history. And then, of course, in the context that we currently live in, it's really hard not to think about
statelessness. Yeah.
Statelessness, exactly. And who the systems that we have that allow us to belong to a place in a legal way and participate in that society in a legal way, and how very fragile and very complicated those systems actually are.
Just to give people a sense of what this looks like in the story, Heejin's mom was originally from North Korea,
yeah.
and she was essentially sold and went through periods of life where she was living in China, and she was considered an illegal immigrant, and you know felt like she couldn't speak out about her situation or you know ask for help because she'd be sent back to North Korea. And she's in South Korea.
So if you are North Korean and you wind up somehow in South Korea and you can prove you are North Korean, you don't have a problem. You are, well, supposedly you are automatically given citizenship. But if you go through China, which many people do because, you know, of the fact that the North to South Korean border is the most heavily militarized border in the world, and you can't prove that you either, you know, because you don't have documents or how long you were in China, that you are in fact a North Korean citizen, then the default response is to ship you back to China and let China deal with it. So it's a little bit, I can already see people that are somewhat familiar with the situation saying, oh, well, North Koreans automatically get citizenship in South Korea. And like, I understand where they're coming from. But again, these systems are very precarious and they require access to good documentation, which a lot of people in these circumstances do not have. And they don't account for things like blended families, where someone might have a Chinese parent and a North Korean parent, and how these government systems would deal with someone like that, which is kind of the situation, as far as they know, that the girls find themselves in.
Yeah. So I'd love for people to hear a little bit of the story. Heejin, the story really gets set into motion for her with a knock at the door late at night. Would you mind reading for us a little bit from the book?
Okay, so she hears a knock at the door, and she's also at this time thinking about her circumstance because there's recently been a article in the newspaper about some people who are in her same legal situation. So who just knocked? Police? My landlord? But wouldn't either have come to the front door that empties out onto the main street instead of the back exit to the alley? Unsure if I imagined it, I wait. The clock reads a barely perceptible 5 a.m., the green numbers having faded as they wait for the sun to recharge the panel on the back. Just as I start to relax, I hear it again. Three knocks, then two, and then a long pause. The silence impales me like a butterfly on a wire. Finally, there's a low thump. I don't want to crawl up from the floor and answer it, but it's like my mother's ghost is working my nerves and my muscles. I cross the linoleum, my slippers going scuff, scuff, and then I take a long breath and open the door. A seated body flops over into my apartment, a woman that lands on her side. Her incredibly muscular, fatless arm is thrown over her face, casting shadows that obscure her identity. But I can make out the gaping hollow underneath her opposite clavicle, and a sternum so harshly defined that it looks like a flint-napped arrowhead. My gaze trails to her filthy hand, which ends in the worst fingernails I've ever seen, jagged and gray, like smoke trapped in a glass, and so opaque that I can't make out the bed from the tip. I circle around her so that I can see her face. My stomach twists in revulsion. The side of her neck, her cheek, her forehead, they're all covered with inch-long spines, as if someone gutted and flattened a sea urchin and somehow melded it with her skin. Even in the washed-out light of the alley, I can see that some are tufted at the end, like paintbrushes, and they lay angling away from the center of her face like a sunflower's seeds, as if she'd slapped herself with such force that the wind of her hand descending to her cheek had knocked all the spines down, like trees away from the explosion of a bomb. I squat to see under her arm, and my breath catches at the sight of her open eyes. They're as large as 500 won coins, so grotesquely swollen and protruding, they look like they're about to pop out of her face. But I recognize the color. My sister and I have the same eyes, dark brown that turns amber in the right light. My mother, superstitious as she was, used to say that Heejin and I shared a soul. This unblinking, demonic-looking body, it has my eyes. Heejin, I whisper, and then I start to cry.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Maria Dong. Her latest book is called Aviary. I mean, wow. Just so people are aware, this book probably should have just a bit of a body horror trigger on it. It's not gratuitous, but this transformation that Heejin goes through is kind of one of the central mysteries of the book. Reading the passages about this were very visceral for me. And I wonder if that's your reaction to thinking about them as well. It's not really an ick factor so much as what does this transformation mean? I mean, were those scenes very hard to write?
I don't think so. I think they're so central to the narrative and the themes of the book that they were some of the easiest to write, actually. Like there were times where I would write one and then realize like the entire 50 pages around it had to change just so that this scene could be preserved the way it was. So they're so important and they're so central, especially like with the, I guess I'll call it the bird motif that's going through the book on many different levels. Those parts I think were some of the easiest and the smoothest. I think that I have a very close relationship with horror in all of my writing, even in those pieces that don't feel particularly horrific, right? It's the distortion of the things that are comfortable, normal. It helps us to see things that maybe it's easy for us to overlook or, you know, file away because we see them so often. The things that happen, particularly to young women, particularly young marginalized women in our society, in our societies, are horrific. Like they're very horrific and they're very physical, visceral horrors. But sometimes, because we're so used to seeing them, it's almost hard to notice them. Whereas if you paint them with something a little bit surreal or a little bit fantastic, it's a way of like drawing your attention to it and kind of making a statement about it without kind of falling under that automatic filtration out.
Yeah. Another piece of this story that we haven't talked about yet is the fact that there's a whole second narrative. Hee-jin, as she's trying to unravel the mystery of her sister's disappearance, has a sort of benefactor named Shepherd who has an ex-wife. I would say wife, but it's they're still like in each other's orbit, but they're not still married. Named Callie, who's sort of a den mother to the young women in this artist residency, albeit a super creepy Mrs. Danvers style den mother. Why did you feel like you wanted another perspective, another female perspective on the events of Hee-jin's journey?
One of the things I meditated on a lot as I was writing this book and through the books that I have written is kind of how we portray villains and the nature of evil. There is this, I think, particularly in thriller and also in fantasy, this strong push to make villains always these like really charismatic, like giant, larger than life, super powerful, super, super scary entities. But the truth is, if you look at our society, a lot of times, like the truly horrific villains are just regular people who maybe have flaky morals and access to a lot of power or privilege. And so I really wanted to kind of give a window into the backstory, the history, and the psychology of the people that ultimately come, like the final villains in this book, and kind of what the evolution of their power looked like. There's a lot of research that shows that one of the best ways to identify if someone's going to be a murderer is if there are reports of them abusing their girlfriends or spouses, for example. So people that do really, truly horrific things often start with kind of small, horrific acts. And when those acts are left to run unchecked, they just kind of like take that as permission to grow and grow and grow. So I think that was a big part of it. Her point of view is extremely contentious. Like a lot of people don't like it, but I felt like it was, you know, really necessary to kind of getting a full understanding of like what's happening in this house.
The other real, I feel, showstopper in this book is the action scenes. I mean, there's this one part where Hee-jin goes full John McClane in Die Hard, like trying to crawl her way through the ductwork in this house where she's kind of a prisoner. And the culmination of the story just kind of had me gasping for breath at how frightening and lurid it sounded. I always feel like this has got to be a really tough kind of scene to tackle, and just from a descriptive standpoint, to like keep things moving along, but also give people a real sense of what it would feel like to be there. What was it like?
I feel like, again, for me, this is actually one of the easier parts to do. My agent calls it like the Maria Dong batshit book structure, where like the first half I'm setting up all of these puzzle box pieces. Like, and so sometimes I know the first half of a lot of my books drags a tiny bit because I'm trying to cram in so many pieces so that once, you know, the tower is all erect, I can drop that marble on the top right around the midpoint. And then the whole thing just goes bananas from there on out. That is like how I write books. It's actually like kind of, I think, from East Asian writing generally. Like if you watch a lot of East Asian movies or read a lot of East Asian books, they tend to work in halves where like the first half you're winding closer and closer to something. And then the second half, everything starts to rapidly fall apart. It's almost like cleanly divided into two almost like different genres.
Yeah.
And I feel like right. This book kind of, yeah, follows that. So it just naturally like is the way that I write. And so after I do write a book and, you know, the book's been edited, I spend a lot of time usually kind of trimming up the first half so it's not dragging. And then the second half, like, you know, adding a little more breathing room, because otherwise it would just be breathless all the way to the end.
Maria Dong's new novel is called Aviary, and she's going to be at This Is a Bookstore in Kalamazoo on April 18th to do a reading and talk more about the book. Watch for her events throughout the state later on. Maria, thank you so much for talking with us. This book was a real rocket ride.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a real pleasure.
It's time for us to pause for a moment. When we come back, a new farmer talks about finding land by getting connected with a retiring farm family.
Farmers used to meet at churches or coffee shops, and that's how they would find the next farmer, right? And the town owner or the son or daughter would take over the farm. Now that natural connection isn't happening, and that's why a platform such as My Farm Link exists.
More on the app that made this match possible in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan is so well known for our iconic fruit farms, growing delicious cherries, crisp apples, fresh blueberries. But that land is very much in demand and disappearing. Did you know that Michigan lost over 6,000 farms in the past decade? Part of the reason for that is that farmers are aging, and as they look to retire, their kids aren't necessarily looking to continue the family business. Some enterprising developers in Ottawa County had this idea for a program called My Farm Link, that's M-I Farm Link, that works kind of like an online dating profile. Its mission is to connect existing farms in Michigan to aspiring farmers who are trying to find some land to buy into. The idea is that farmers might ultimately be able to avoid selling their land to people who are not so into farming. Joining us today to tell more is Jill Doner. She's the director of Michigan Farm Link in its current incarnation. The program went statewide in October and has made 13 successful links in the past 2 years. Jill Doner, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us today, Simon and Caitlin Yevzelman. They are farmers now who were able to take over a certified organic farm in Belleville, thanks to Michigan Farm Link. And they have grown that land into a successful business, the Cedar Field Farm. Caitlin, Simon, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Jill, there are people hearing this right now in rural areas who probably know exactly what you're talking about in terms of what's happening with farmland. But for those who aren't as familiar, what are the economic pressures in terms of land on farmers right now? Who is it who's trying to buy their land?
Yeah, so, I mean, the issue is, and what we're seeing and why I think My Farm Link and other platforms and farmland protection are coming to the news are that there's a lot of pressure on farmland, solar data centers, development. There's a lot of urban sprawl happening in our areas. And so that pressure is putting farmland prices that are exponentially high at the moment. Last year alone, Michigan had the highest percentage increase of farmland prices in the nation. So you can see kind of that pressure on farmers to either sell their land and or sell it to a developer or a solar farm or anything else other than kind of keeping it in farming and agriculture.
Right. Now, let's switch over to Caitlin and Simon now. Can you tell us a little bit about your life before farming and why you decided that you wanted this change?
Yeah, sure. well, I've been farming for about 10 years, but the last two have been my first foray into farming outdoors. I have a master's degree in sustainable aquaculture, which led me down a the path for fish farming. I don't know why I did that, but I ended up doing that for a few years. And then ended up doing some hydroponic leafy green production in Detroit. Those were really capital intensive, controlled environment situations. And the last 2 years and going on 3 years of organic practice vegetable farming is a welcome shift into the seasonality of it.
I hope we can have you back sometime to talk about your experiences with aquaculture, because I've always been really curious about that. But I don't know, Caitlin, how about you? What were you doing before you got into this?
Wildly different things. I spent most of my career in marketing and advertising, working in the data and analytics side. The last role that I left was a DEI role, working in automotive. So this was quite a different pace for me. I definitely appreciate the transferable skills of, you know, working on the computer, working on our systems. But I would say we kind of split our time. You know, Simon's kind of the farming brain and I'm kind of handling the business side of things.
You know, marketing is a big part of farming, no matter what kind of farming you're doing. So I know that's important. What were some of the challenges that you two ran into when you started thinking about getting some land?
I think we've probably talked to maybe at least 15 farms through Michigan FarmLink. And this all started back in 2021. And we've done everything from site visits, just emailing and phone calls. We've gone and processed animals with farms before. So it's been kind of a long journey. And looking back, I think when we decided to farm, I didn't realize that leasing would be an opportunity.
Had you tried to acquire land just on your own before getting connected with MyFarmLink?
We had done a little bit of, you know, window shopping, you know, when you're after work ends and you're both on Zillow together, you know, dreaming about what you'd be able to do with this house or that.
Okay. I just want to say, Simon, a lot of people just use that time for, man, what if we could get this lake house, or, hey, check out that condo. But you guys were trolling Zillow land. Okay. Zillow farmland.
I was just scrolling past all of the interior pictures just to see what the yard looked like. Yeah, so we had kind of casually been looking, but when we had talked to other farms at Michigan through Michigan Farm, MyFarmLink, it became clear that while we were hoping to purchase a business and have an existing business to keep going, many times it's the real estate that could stand in the way of that. And that makes sense. There's a ton of farmers retiring. We have a really aging farmer population in the state and also in this nation. And somebody living on a piece of property, putting their whole life into it, you know, really needs to see an outcome from that when they're really ready to sell and go move closer to grandkids or whatever it might be.
Caitlin, I was being kind of flip when I said it was sort of like doing an online dating profile. Can you maybe talk about that? Like what it was like, what led you to set up the profile and what it was like sort of going public in that way?
Yeah, I've never actually been on a dating profile, so I don't actually have a comparison for that. But it was very simple. You go in there, you make an account, Now there are so many more filters and categories that you can add in there, which is great because every land you're going to come across is different. You can't just plop in an orchard just somewhere that's near you. So in the profile, I know you can kind of section it off by county. You can be more specific, I think, down to the city. A lot of people put in what their farming experience is. And I actually love reading some of the profiles because we've looked for employees through the platform as well. So there are so many people who are interested in farming, don't have the experience. And this is really, you know, a good way to bridge that land access.
Can I pivot back to Jill for a minute? Jill, when in designing the website and getting it where it needed to be more of a statewide service, what were some considerations that you needed to build into it to make it accessible both for the farmers who are thinking about selling and for folks like Caitlin and Simon who need to demonstrate their intentions?
there was a lot of back and forth in designing this website, the version 2.0, shall we say. It looked similar to a Zillow website initially, where it was just the farmland properties, and they were interesting and had beautiful pictures, but there wasn't the two-way connection, the back and forth. There were no farm seeker profiles, of which now there are over 800 in the state of Michigan now. And that just says, like, there's farmers out there. There's willing and ready to farm and be on the land.
So there are definitely people out there. But what did you need to do to make the website useful for both potential sellers and potential buyers?
So to set it up so that farmers can communicate with each other, I made sure that there was a profile system online that you were able to publish your profile through it. But I wanted it to make sure that only folks that were going on the website and actually wanted to communicate with other farmers could do that. So every single profile that you see online right now has been overseen by our eyes and made sure that they are indeed a farmer, they're not a robot, they have the good information. And so really we were trying to enable that connection between farmland owner and farm seeker. And so now it's really in the hands of the farmers to continue those conversations and to set up farm visits, to go out to other farms and help handle their animals. It's through those communication and those multitude of connections that happen that you'll eventually find that land transition happen.
The match, right.
The match, yes. The successful match, the link. You know, it's kind of the golden ticket.
The golden rose, if you're a Bachelor fan, okay.
Yes, exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jill Doner of My Farm Link. And also we're talking with Caitlin and Simon Yevselman. They're the proprietors of Cedarfield Farm, and they got that farm through My Farm Link and matching up with a farmer who was ready to sell. Simon, Caitlin, tell us a little bit about who you ended up meeting. Like, who was the match that you found?
Well, it actually kind of started because we bought a house together in Dearborn Heights for a lot of reasons, but it ended up being just total serendipity that there was a farm for lease in Belleville. The owner of that farm was growing there for, I think, 5 years before he put it up for lease. He had been doing a variety of different crops there and had started a new business venture down in Toledo, where he's from, and was looking for a lessee. We, on our first visit, we really aligned really well. He, was about our age, really similar experiences, cared about the environment, cared about quality food, and he put in a lot of infrastructure and time into that farm, which is what made it possible for us. It was essentially a turnkey situation. Irrigation, solar power, greenhouses, a little bit of fencing, those kinds of things made it possible for us to sign a lease on February 28th and literally get shovels in the ground on March 1st. So it was a quick turnaround, but it was all made possible because of that connection of somebody 35 minutes away that without the website, we probably never would have met him.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. Jill, not everybody has it, I'm sure, as easy as Simon and Caitlin. Can you talk a little bit about why it is that it's not just a matter of connecting a farmer who has land with somebody who wants to grow something on the land? What are some of the challenges in finding the best relationship for a transfer?
Yeah, I mean, Simon and Caitlin's successful link was definitely, I like to call it a farm on a platter. You know, they had that infrastructure ready to go, and it did lead to a really good, successful link. For others, it takes so much more time and communication to get to the right lease agreement, employment opportunity, mentorship to start off with. It's really difficult for our aging farming population to relinquish that land. That's a really difficult move to, it's tied to their livelihood. And that's really difficult for a younger generation, particularly if they're trying to transition it over to
a non-family member and they don't have an heir to take it over, it's really difficult to aid in that transition. And so we really try to come in from my farm link to provide them with the resources, the succession planning, the additional templates that can write out a leasing agreement so that that can be a successful transition.
Jill, do you mean it can be difficult because it's so personal and farming is, I mean, it's not just a job for the people who do it? Or do you mean the fact that it's not like a case where you're selling a house and the bank pays it all off, that there needs to be a different kind of payment structure? Is that what you mean?
Yes. I mean, it's challenging because you think about when my mother-in-law retired, she was a teacher. She got to have a big party. She sold all her books. She got rid of her teacher clothes and long dresses that she once wore. And she kind of got to retire. When farmers retire, they still live at their property. They have so much dedication and work and put into their land that it's very difficult to kind of sever ties because it's what they did their entire lives and they want to see that continuing on. Back in the day, farmers used to meet at churches or coffee shops, and that's how they would find the next farmer, right? And the town owner or the son or daughter would take over the farm. Now that natural connection isn't happening, and that's why a platform such as MyFarmLink exists. There are 37 other platforms such as these, farm linking or land linking websites in the United States, but Michigan is relatively new to get their own.
Jill, what would you say about why this process and this work is important?
It's really important because farmland protection is the number one threat to our agricultural systems. Michigan is number two in the most diverse specialty crops in the nation. We're right behind California, but we have water. So I see through our platform and our number of multitude of farm seekers, that folks want to live here. They want to settle here. They want to retire here and farm here. We've got a good agricultural identity going. I always talk about our Michigan identity, and you think about what we do in the fall. We go to pumpkin patches and corn mazes.
My cider family, we orchards, go, cider
yes,
donuts,
apple orchards. Yeah, right. We cut down a Christmas tree every year, my family, to the same one we've been going to for 30 plus years. Michiganders love their agriculture, and we need to support our farmers who are doing just that.
Caitlin, Simon, will you tell us before you go how the business has been going and what might be next for you?
Yeah. Also wanted to add on to what Jill was saying, just as somebody who's going through now, I guess, my second career, being able to connect with all these farmers and like go see what it's like on their farms has really been eye-opening and an experience that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And it's kind of accelerated my understanding of farming and being thrown right into this. Now we're heading into year three of growing.
So we do a CSA, basically a subscription-only model. First year, we grew everything that we sold. The second year, we were able to source from many farms around us. And this year, we're going to continue that and keep expanding our supply shed, expand more into our community of Dearborn Heights, which is really important to us, being kind of right between the vibrant local food scenes in Detroit and Ann Arbor. So we've got big plans. We'll see. Hopefully we'll need to bring an employee or two on board if things go well. We're excited and looking forward to the future. We're going to need a bigger van. That's what we'll need.
Caitlin and Simon Yevzelman are the proprietors of Cedar Field Farm in Belleville. We've also been talking with Jill Doner, who's the director of My Farm Link. Simon, Caitlin, thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, April.
And Jill, thank you very much for your work and for telling us about it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's it for Stateside for today. Our show's producers are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansug, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Molly Anderson, Astrid Cole, and Maximilian Resch. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. Find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Take care.